We all know Jimmy Buffett. Of course you know Jimmy Buffett if you're listening to WGN Radio right now. Jimmy Buffett's been in all of our lives, for most of our lives, certainly in my life. He was already long around by the time I was listening to music. This July 15th, the ultimate party venue of Wrigley Field will be host to the ultimate party guy, Jimmy Buffett. He's coming to town for a concert at Wrigley Field. I haven't seen Buffett in concert, my God, I think in 20 years. And I don't remember if that was at Poplar Creek or Alpine Valley or out in Tinley Park. But Jimmy Buffett is back, and the book Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way by Ryan White is out in hardback right now. On page 110, let me read from the book for a second. It says, folk singer in concert, read a nearly hidden headline on page 19 of the third section of Dalton Pointer on February 28, 1974. Jimmy Buffett in concert at noon on a Monday in the Student Faculty Center on the campus of Purdue University, Calumet in Hammond, Indiana, read the story. Admission free. That's not a gig you play for fame. You play Hammond, Indiana at noon on a Monday in early March because it's your job. And I'll tell you what, as somebody who grew up next door in Munster, Indiana, I'll tell you that is damn true. And that cracked me up. Ryan White, the author of the book, joined us on the phone. Hey, Ryan, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. I love that that was the passage that that you pulled from that and connected. That was, I was flipping through old newspapers one day and went, wow.
Well, it cracked me up because, Ryan, I don't know how well you know Hammond, Indiana, but back in 74, Hammond, Indiana was probably so much better than it is right now. It's definitely fallen on very tough times. And, you know, just thinking of Buffett playing Purdue University Calumet at noon on a Monday kills us because here is this, party singer and amazing businessman who Buffett has become. And to think about him playing college shows for free, in the faculty center at noon on a Monday is just really tells you a little bit about where Buffett really came from. I've gotten through the first half of your book, Ryan, and it's really the background of how Buffett became Buffett before Margaritaville, before the business, before everything else, before he became just such a, I don't know, you know, we'll get into this later, but maybe a business as much as a musician at some points. It was all about music and music and music and playing music. And Buffett really is the old classic American tale, isn't he, of a musician doing it his own way. He wasn't radio friendly. Nobody could figure out how they were going to market this guy at a time when you had to be on radio. It's not like you could throw your songs up on YouTube and kids would find you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the great, you know, I don't know, the paradox is quite the right word, but, you know, he always knew who he was. Nobody else could figure him out. And it is exactly right. You know, one of the things that Don Light, his original manager in Nashville, or his first manager after he went to Key West, he'd had a few other people helping him when he was in Nashville before he kind of flunked out of Nashville for the first time. You know, one of the things that Don Light, you know, said was that, you know, he could never, doors never permanently shut for Jimmy Buffett because people really liked Jimmy Buffett. But the constant mantra was, we like him, but we can't get him on the radio. And in Nashville at that time especially, they just didn't have the imagination to see any other way to get a hit. And you know, it's a town that still to this day, where publishing is king, where hits matter. You know, at the time, the Nashville sound was a thing, and it was this big, orchestrated huge country sound with these amazing voices like George Jones singing it, and Chet Atkins got a lot of credit for it, and people used to ask Chet Atkins, what is the Nashville sound, what's that sound like, and he would jingle the change in his pocket like it sounds like money.
Yeah.
And you know, Jimmy didn't fit that mold. He was too folk for Nashville, he was too country for New York, he never had a genre, and he just worked on stage. And what Don Light discovered back then was, you know, if you play the student union on a Monday in Hammond, Indiana, and 20 people show up, well, the next time he goes back there, they're going to be 40. And the time after that, there's going to be 80. And pretty soon you've moved up to a club and you're doing multiple nights, and then you need a bigger venue because people liked Buffett. They liked his songs. They liked him. He was charming on stage. He was funny. He would, light. And Don, I should add, Don Light died a couple of years before I started working on this, but Peter Cooper, who's a fantastic journalist and songwriter in Nashville, had a very long interview with him that he was lovely enough to give me access to. And, Light said that, Jimmy would be great at getting to towns, and before he went on stage, he would pick up a paper like the one that that ad was in, and he would scan the headlines, and he would find some piece of local culture, and it might be a contentious piece of local culture, something that was being fought about in the city council or whatever, that he could use on stage to connect with people. And he does that to this day. I mean, if you go see him live, you're going to get a local geography lesson, whether you know it intimately as somebody who lives there and spends all your time around these places, or if you're, just visiting because you're a Jimmy Buffett fan and he's on the road and you had a chance to go see him, he knows the ins and outs of the places that he plays, and that's been part of the connection that he's had for so long.
When we look back at the tough time he had really getting his footing, and you talk about him saying, well, if there's only 20 people today, they're going to love you. Next time, there's going to be 40 people. What a tough way to make a living and to break into it. Was there ever a real temptation for Buffett to figure out a different way to write that hit song? It sounds like he never set out to truly, I mean, of course, he wanted to be a success and things like that, but it sounds like he never said, how can I get on the radio? He believed in his songs and wanted people to follow along so that they eventually made it there. Was there ever a time where he's like, ah, screw this, we got to just make a song that sells records so we can quit, playing the student union with 20 people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they probably took some attempts at that then got tossed aside. I mean, he's always, he's always been pretty true to his quirky little sense of humor, and especially once he got to Key West. I mean, the characters and the stuff, just the atmosphere that was in the air down there in the 70s, if you were going to write about that in life on the road as he was living it, because a lot of those, for those early Key West records, while the iconography is all tropical in Key West, there's a lot of songs set out in Texas and Nashville, because simultaneously he was really making a living in that Texas scene that was just beginning in Austin, because Willie moved down there from Nashville and Jerry Jeff Walker showed up, and Jimmy was playing the same clubs as Lightnin' Hopkins down there and stuff, and he was getting out west. He was having a little bit of success in the Bay Area, and Tom McGuain, who he met in Key West, had a place out in Montana. So you end up with a song like "Ringling, Ringling," set in this tiny little town in Ringling, Montana. That we talk about towns that you'll miss if you blink. It really is a town that you will miss if you blink. I drove over there when I was doing some writing in Livingston last summer, trying to finish the book. And he couldn't do any. He was around all of these people who were chasing their own visions, and I think he couldn't help but do his. And he was having just enough success to keep working. And he has a strong work ethic, and he has always had a strong work ethic. And so, he did it. I think he understood that there was not an easy way to do it. You put in the work and you put in the miles. And you go and you do that. And I think one of the things that I had hoped, I could maybe remind people of through this book, because he has become, as you said, such a big figure in the culture, and Margaritaville has become such a big business, is what it was like at the beginning. Because you can forget that sometimes. You can become so familiar with somebody's one or two songs that you can forget, not only the other songs, but the work that went into it. And I mean, and he was out there. I mean, he was a road dog. He's still a road dog. He's just a road dog in a private jet now.
Yeah, he is. All right, so when we talk about some of the singers at the time who did make it, who are also maybe a little bit hard to define, like Dylan or Jim Croce or some of these other guys that, Buffett to me, seems, especially with some of those early songs, like one of those guys, but with irony. And so there was no place for that. It's like you really had to be a serious, indie folk artist, or you had to go another direction, but you couldn't be Buffett. Was Buffett sort of undefinable in that way, because there was a happiness or an irony with his songs, that he wasn't just serious and maudlin all the time? He would be serious, but there'd be a twist in there that you know, took you out of that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. And he was sentimental too, like, you know, for Dylan, for you know, all of his immense talents and many, many charms, you know, as a character and a jester and everything, you know, he's not a particularly sentimental person, and can more often than not have a very, very hard edge. You know, Michael Utley, who's the only other guy besides Jimmy to play on every Buffett record since 1973, and has been a full-time Coral Reefer since about 1982, and is, you know, currently musical director of the Coral Reefer band, and has been for some time. Utley was playing with Kris Kristofferson for quite a while in the early 70s, while he would then, you know, have a break from touring and go join Jimmy in the studio to play on the records and stuff. And you know, talking with Mike, he talked about all of the very kind of tragic figures that he came into around, you know, around that time. And Kristofferson was certainly writing these, you know, heartbreaking, gorgeous, hard-edged songs that were turning Nashville, you know, on its head before Nashville really realized that it was being turned on its head. You know, it took Johnny Cash doing Sunday Morning Coming Down before people started to finally realize that this scruffy-looking guy who'd been pushing a broom over at one of the studios was going to change the way music was done. And Kristofferson kind of was one of the first ones to push through after Dylan had gone to Nashville to record Blonde on Blonde. That started bringing people that weren't just country singers to Nashville. And you know, the word that gets thrown around in that era a lot is literate. And Jimmy's stuff was certainly literate. But yeah, it wasn't fatalistic.
Yeah.
As like a lot of the literature that was coming out of Key West, his pals like Harrison and McGuane, who were really kind of, you know, in their own ways chasing Hemingway's ghost, there was a fatalism to those books. And Jimmy never quite had that. He could never quite go dark, and he understood it. He understood that completely. There's a great story in the book that Tom Corcoran, who's been Jimmy's friend since, you know, he gave him his first beer in Key West. Tom told me that the fantastic song "Woman Going Crazy on Caroline Street" began as a Shel Silverstein poem, in a very, very dark poem, and Jimmy loved it and was going to record it, and he brought it up to Chicago, and he played it for Steve Goodman, and Goodman looked at him and said, "That's amazing, but you can't record that. It's too dark for you, and it's not who you are." And so they sat down and they reworked it, and when they played it for Shel, as Tom tells the story, Shel was like, "And that's your song now. You don't need to give me a writing credit on that. That's fantastic. But you changed it and made it your own."
Yeah.
And that's how, between the test pressing and the final version of Havana Day Dreaming, Shel Silverstein's writing credit came off of "Woman Going Crazy on Caroline Street." But you know, Jimmy knew it, and his friends knew it. You know, Steve Goodman heard it and was like, "It's fantastic, but that's not you." And you know, being somebody other than yourself, and Jimmy tried it a few times in the 80s, you know, people really pushed him towards kind of the new country sound there, which is how you ended up with like Riddles in the Sand, which I actually think has some really interesting songs on it. But, you know, he was not going to be a new Nashville star until one day, you know, he looked up and everybody in Nashville was playing Jimmy Buffett songs.
Yeah.
It took him being himself for everybody else to finally come to him.
Ryan, like, so I imagine there's two sets of people out there. There's people that know Jimmy Buffett because Jimmy Buffett is ubiquitous, and there's people that know Jimmy Buffett because they know a lot of these songs you're talking about in the whole first half of your book about him finding his way in the original songs. I'd never heard of most of those songs. I own one Jimmy Buffett CD that I bought, you know, back when CDs came out when I was a kid out of high school, and it's a greatest hits album. And on it, I'm sure he's had more since then, but there's 13 songs on it, all of them produced 1979 or earlier. And it's interesting to me as I look at it right now, because I just got to the point in the book where they record Margaritaville. And I know that everything's going to really change after that. He'd already had success with Come Monday. You know, that had been his real success, I think, so far as airplay, things like that.
Yeah.
He had great success in the fact that he was, you know, packing concert halls everywhere he went, because like you said, he was a road dog and he went out there and he worked it and people fell in love with the guy, even if they weren't hearing him on the radio. But I want to ask you about, so when I look at the on the Greatest Hits CD, they list when all the songs were recorded and produced. And Margaritaville hits in 77. And when I look at the songs before that, you have A Pirate Looks at 40 in 74. He Went to Paris in 73. Pencil Thin Mustache in 74. To me, more of a Jim Croce-esque type of Buffett. And then after Margaritaville, it's in Come Monday in 74. So real wistful type songs, Looking Back, things like that. After Margaritaville in 77, we also have Boat Drinks and Volcano and Fins and Cheeseburger in Paradise. And I wonder if Margaritaville became an embracing of, okay, this is what people really love. We're going to give them a little more of this.
Not quite yet at that point. I mean, what really changed was, you know, those first four albums were recorded in Nashville, and they were mostly recorded with studio musicians, which included Michael Utley and Doyle Grisham, who is the pedal steel player now in the Coral Reefer Band. He played on those early Nashville records as just a session guy, and you know, kind of remembers that era period as one where he just met Jimmy in a studio one day, and Jimmy said, "Hey, when I make my record," and Jimmy didn't have a deal yet. He was like, "Hey, when I make my record, will you come play on it?" And Doyle, I had lunch with or breakfast with Doyle in Key West, and he goes, "You know, it was Nashville. People said a lot of things, and you just said yes to everything, and almost none of it happened." But then he got his deal, and he called me up just like he said he would. And he had Jimmy at that period. He really wanted a little more artistic control. He wanted to use what became the first iteration of the Coral Reefer Band in 1975, which is a fantastic band. Wild and crazy but he didn't want to do the things the way that they had been done, and so he had had just a sliver of success with Come Monday, and it gave him enough credibility to get a new record deal in 1976, and he searched out Norbert Putnam to produce the next record, which became Changes in Latitude, Changes in Attitude. And Norbert was one of the original Muscle Shoals musicians. He played on the earliest hits out of Muscle Shoals before realizing that he could make more money playing bass in the studio in Nashville. And he went up there and he eventually played on, you know, 120 Elvis songs. And he and I were sitting in a wine bar in Florence, Alabama, and Ray Charles comes on. And I said, "Did you ever play with Ray?" He goes, "I did Hee Haw with Ray." And so Norbert has stories like that. And Norbert had done a bunch of production work with Dan Fogelberg. And he had noticed that Fogelberg worked better when they were in the mountains of Denver, of Colorado, than when they were in the canyons of Los Angeles. And so he looked at Buffett and he said, excuse me, losing my voice here. He looked at Buffett and he said, "We got to get you to the ocean. Let's go to Miami and record." The way Norbert remembers it, Jimmy wasn't entirely sold on the idea, but he called him back a couple days later and he'd written Changes in Latitudes, Changes in Attitudes, and said, "Okay, let's do it." And so they went to Miami and they recorded Margaritaville, and Jimmy had just, he'd used half of his money from his new record deal to buy the Euphoria, his first sailboat. And they had this idea that they would work for 5 or 6 hours a day, take the tapes out onto the boat and listen to how the music played on the water. And Norbert remembers one day they were listening to the day's work and thinking, "Yeah, you know, this sounds pretty good out there." And Jimmy looked out around the harbor and said, "Imagine if we could just sell records to everybody who had a boat." And Norbert kind of describes it as he kind of looked around the harbor too and started to see dollar signs floating over every mast. and that's kind of what happened. But it was with Norbert's assistance that they got out of Nashville, went down to Miami, and then, you know, the world kind of opened up and the sounds kind of opened up. Norbert wanted to bring in more tropical sounding instrumentation to that record. And I think it expanded the musical world at a time when suddenly Jimmy had success in the resources to expand his own world. And he had the sailboat to go down into the Caribbean. So you started getting, you know, not consciously written songs, but songs that were written from the same way that there were early songs written, you know, like "Life Is Like a Tire Swing" came together when he wrecked a car in the morning after staying up all night trying to get back to the to the airport from a gig in Illinois there, you know, that was his life then. He was wrecking rental cars with some regularity, it turns out, and getting stories out of that. Now he had a sailboat, and he was pulling stories from the Caribbean. It was only kind of, you know, it was only kind of when the parrot head thing started in the mid-'80s and really grew into the 90s that I think he started consciously recognizing that, you know, there was an audience out there and they responded to this, and he should, you know, he should write some songs to it. I asked Mike Utley about that. He said, you know, he goes, you stand on that stage and you see what we see every night. Eventually you're going to write some songs about that.
Yeah,
it's inevitable.
The book is Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way. We're speaking with Ryan White about the life and times and continuing good times of Jimmy Buffett. More next on 720 WGN.
Wasting away again in Margaritaville, searching for my lost sugar salt. Some people claim that there's a woman to blame, but I know it's nobody's fault.
Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. That's Jimmy Buffett in the background. The book, Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way by Ryan White. It's available in bookstores now. You can find more from Ryan on his website, ryanwwhite.com. Ryan, you were talking about the recording of the Changes in Latitude album, right? It was They go down to Miami, they're recording that. It's got Changes in Latitude. It's also got Margaritaville on it. And you mentioned that they decided they would record for 5 hours a day and then go listen on the boat. But that's not how I read it in the book. I read it more as the producer said, it gets really sloppy when you guys record for too long. So we're going to limit this because I know how this goes. You end up wasting a bunch of hours in the studio when you guys have had a few too much. Because you set it up really nice. It's really a cool story about how they do this that it was kind of, it sounds like a thriving business at the time of musicians coming down to Miami, renting a mansion and recording for a while. And so
yeah,
they have this mansion,
and
Buffett has control now, so he brings the entire band, brings the road crew, who he spends most of his life with, right, because he spends so much time on the road, so they get to come hang out too, and there's a full bar at the mansion and everything, so probably a really good producer note to say, why don't we not do this for too long every day, because there's going to be some wasted time on this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Norbert was funny because he remembered one of his first conversations with Jimmy when they sat down to talk about the record at a really nice restaurant in Nashville. And Norbert had, you know, he'd seen Jimmy play solo acoustic shows at places like the Exit Inn before. But he'd been there on other business and he had half an ear on it and he wasn't paying much attention. He knew come Monday, that was about it. And Jimmy sat down and tried to explain to him that, like, he had this band and it was a really good band. And we're more like the Rolling Stones than we are, you know, what you would imagine us to be. And Norbert looks at me, he goes, and I'm sitting there, I'm trying to imagine the Rolling Stones playing come Monday, and it's just not computing. But they were playing Nashville like a week later, and he went out, and what they really reminded him of was New Riders of the Purple Sage, who he'd produced in L.A., where he just described it was basically, okay, we're going to drink everything that's in here, we're going to snort everything that's in here, and then we're going to try and make a record. Norbert was the two really smart things Norbert did was he didn't want to work too long, and part of that was, you know, everybody gets sloppy, and part of it was he was successful enough that he didn't need to do 14-hour days in the studio at that point. That wasn't how he wanted to spend his time. But he also brought in, because they had a road band, and sometimes road bands are so new in the studio that they don't quite know how to translate that and how to work in the studio. And he knew that the one person who, if it wasn't right, would screw up the entire recording process was the drummer. He snuck Kenny Buttrey, who was this just session ace up in Nashville, that he snuck him in there under the guise of, well, he's a percussionist. You know, sometimes you might need a percussionist on top of the drums. And on Margaritaville, they were having trouble getting the drums right. So he talked Jimmy into letting Kenny Buttrey give it a try. And it's the second or third take with Buttrey on drums that we've been hearing now for 40 years.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And so you don't write it in the book, but I'm wondering, was that you might need a percussionist. He knew that if this goes wrong, we need, you know, that's where the whole album grinds to a halt. But is that a little more than you're saying of a you know, maybe a knock on the drummer at the time that he thought, this, you know, I'm going to have this backup here because I don't know about this guy. Was the producer concerned about the percussionist that Jimmy had?
No, I think it was really just he knew that it was that one, like, you can do almost anything else with good players in the studio, but if the drummer in the studio is not right, it's going to knock, it's a terrible line, but it's going to knock everything out of rhythm. And so I think it was just kind of a safety blanket. Like, you know, we're taking this band that's never really been in the studio together. We're taking them out of Nashville to a place where they've never recorded. Like, we just need this one, kind of, in case of emergency, break glass option. And that was Kenny Buttrey, who very quickly thereafter became the touring drummer with the Coral Reefer Band too. I mean, it became a pretty fluid lineup there for a number of years. They went through a lot of guitar players and a handful of drummers and other people for a while. They were living awfully hard and running awfully fast.
You mentioned that Buffett's still a road dog. He just travels differently these days. I'm looking on his website right now, margaritaville.com, and he's got about 20-some dates between now and the fall. So he is out there working, maybe not as crazy as he used to be, but here's a guy that doesn't need to do this anymore who is still doing it like crazy. And I often wonder about bands like the Stones or U2 who maybe aren't recording a ton of new material but still go out and pack these places and still do it. And they already have so much money, so you start to wonder, what is it? Is it truly just they love being in front of a crowd and they can't get away from that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the first book that I wrote, Springsteen Album by Album, Bruce talks about, he's like, you know, why would one go out and do this for 3.5 or 4 hours? Because one has to. Because there's some essential part of oneself that drives one to do it. I mean, last year, Jimmy was talking about not touring this summer, and I asked Mike Utley about that when we were talking, and Utley, Utley just got to roll his eyes, and when he's like, yeah, I've heard that a few times before. And, you know, next thing you know, you've got it's certainly not a heavy touring schedule compared to what some bands will do this year, but it's a heavier tour schedule than Jimmy's had in maybe the last year or two. And, you know, they're going to go over to Paris again, and they just got back from Australia and New Zealand. And, he used that as an excuse to go surfing in Fiji and the bone fishing and, on Christmas Island and see a little bit more of the world, which is, you know, he is constantly, moving forward, still at 70. And I think that's one of the other things that people really connect to and appreciate is that, you know, things change and the concept of change was kind of the driving force behind this whole book and trying to, you know, understand how you deal with it and how you can deal with it better. You know, none of that is explicit in the book, but it was certainly in my thinking as I reported and as I wrote, and I tried to figure things out on my own through that story. But even as responsibilities grow, and you know, there's that old line, you know, I used to rule my world from a payphone. You can't do it from a payphone anymore, in part because there are no more payphones. But he's managed to strike that balance, and he's managed to continue to kind of search out adventure and try and do new things and take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves. And I think people kind of relate to that and admire that.
Let's talk more about Jimmy Buffett post-Margaritaville. He became a business juggernaut, still touring, still selling out, even if there haven't been a lot more hits on the radio. Let's talk a little bit more about Jimmy Buffett today with Ryan White, the author of Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way. We'll do that after the news, which is next on 720 WGN.
Yes, I am a pirate, 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder, there's nothing to plunder. I'm an over 40 victim of fate, arriving too late, arriving too late.
Jimmy Buffett and his Coral Reefer Band, you hear them there, you will see them if you are so inclined, July 15th at Wrigley Field. Jimmy Buffett says that he has become a lifelong Cubs fan because of his friend Steve Goodman, who we met way back in the day. On his website, Ryan, he writes that Chicago was the first place outside of the South to recognize Jimmy Buffett. and he appreciates that. So it should be a good show here in Chicago. So they record the Margaritaville album that has Changes in Latitude, Changes in Attitude, and Margaritaville on it. Do things? I mean, he's already got a contract, a good contract. He's already got a boat. He's got a lot going on. Do things truly change for him once Margaritaville hits?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of stratospheric. They spent part of that year opening for the Eagles, who were the biggest band in the world at that point, and really learning how to work the big stage. And you know, now, you know, suddenly the euphoria becomes the euphoria too, and he adds about, I think it was 15 more feet of boat to what he had before, which opens up, you know, more opportunity and longer voyages, and, you know, a level of fame that in some ways became a real problem down in Key West, because, you know, as we talked about Margaritaville being, you know, kind of marking the end of that wild period that he found, the tourists were starting to find it, and now he was the only thing on that island, like, you know, and people would show up on his front door and they'd with a six pack of beer and they'd want to get drunk with Jimmy Buffett. And that wasn't something that he was particularly interested in. So he moved to Aspen, where all the, you know, where he was one of the smaller fish in the celebrity sea, as everybody was moving to Aspen. And in a weird kind of cultural exchange program, he moved to Aspen and he sublet his apartment to Hunter S. Thompson, who was going through a divorce. So Hunter moved to Key West and just rained chaos on that island for a while. There's probably a whole other book just about things Hunter Thompson destroyed while he was living in Jimmy Buffett's apartment. Everybody had a Hunter story down there, and they're happy to tell them.
I can imagine.
But so he became this, he was a star, and he enjoyed hanging out with the stars. And that did, you know, that would impact the pace of your writing at the very least. Whereas, you know, and this is true for anybody who writes and records music, I've found in talking to people over the years, is before anybody knows who you are, you're writing and you're writing and you're writing and you're writing, and you have this huge collection of songs. And then if you're lucky enough to have somebody offer you a record contract, you record 10, 12, 15 of them. And you start touring. And you start, you know, doing press. You start doing all of these things that are required of you. And it's suddenly time to make another record. And it's fine. You've still got a big collection of songs. But it dwindles over time. And you know, you weed out the stuff that you think you don't think is any good, or you don't want to release. And it's harder and harder to sit down and write. And, you know, the fantastic 1978 live album, You Had to Be There, came out of the fact that the record label wanted another record fast, and Jimmy just didn't have many songs at that point. It was, things were moving too fast, and he hadn't had time to sit down and write, so they got a really great live record out of it. But, you know, that's, you know, part of the trade-off, and that's one of the things that you have to wrestle with. And, you know, those immediate records after Margaritaville were all, you know, there's some really, really good stuff on there, and there's some good records, but they, once again, couldn't get them on the radio. It was almost like radio realized, like, hey, wait, how did this, was there a hole in the fence that Jimmy Buffett got through that got him on the radio with Margaritaville? And they ran and they patched it up. So he had a couple of more top 40 hits after that, but, you know, not much after that, and was really kind of, you know, fading in record sales and stuff in the mid-80s when suddenly the Parrothead phenomenon started. And it was kind of like the original days. Radio wasn't interested. The record company didn't quite know what to do with them. But the crowds were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he went back to Key West one day and ran into an old friend who was going through a divorce and having a bit of a hard time. And he said, you know, let's open up a T-shirt shop. I'll put my name on it. You can run it. And if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, we tried it, and that was the first Margaritaville store, a 500-square-foot shop, and, you know, Sunshine Smith, his friend he opened it with, she now gets points on the Flamingo Casino just like Jimmy does. She and Mike Utley and Jimmy and a few other people all went to Las Vegas in 2000, I think it was 12, to testify before the Nevada Gaming Control Board to get their casino operators' licenses, so it worked out.
It's so what launched the Parrothead phenomena? What was the change? Because he's already drawn crowds. Everything's going on. Was it licensing? Was it merchandising? What suddenly changed versus just, well, he's drawing crowds wherever he goes?
It was the sense of community, and they started kind of dressing up. And, you know, Tom Corcoran noticed it far, far before before anybody else did. He wrote a he wrote a piece for Cream magazine in 1978, and he had this fantastic line where, you know, he talked about how, you know, nobody was drinking margaritas before 1977, and now everybody's drinking them like they've been drinking them forever. I mean, they weren't even drinking them in Key West before that, and now you can't escape them. And there was, you know, people wanted to be a little bit like those people in those songs. People wanted to pretend that they were Phil Clark, who was actually the pirate, and a pirate looks at 40, and they wanted it without the consequences of being Phil Clark, which is what a pirate looks at 40 gives you, because you hear you get the fantastic spirit of who Phil Clark was, but, you know, he eventually disappeared and was, you know, found washed ashore in Northern California, and nobody ever really knows what happened to him. You know, he got busted a couple of times for running stuff. And so it was all of the magic and the mystery of, you know, these places and these escapes, without any of the consequences for, you know, the course of an album or the course of a show. And what really kind of, you know, sparked it, and again, it was organic and somewhat, you know, separate of Jimmy Buffett, was in the early 90s, a guy named Scott Nickerson in Atlanta looked around at one of the shows that he was at, and he realized, I see the same people at these shows every year, and we all get along, and we have this thing in common that we like Jimmy Buffett. And I don't see them again until the next year when Jimmy comes back. And so he put a little ad in a free newspaper in Atlanta to try and get some people together. And that was the beginning of the first Parrot Head Club. And now there's more than 200 of them around the country. I've been busy emailing each of them individually, and there are a lot of Parrot Head Clubs, and you realize it when you try to email them each individually. And you know, Scott's this fantastic, fantastic guy. He plays drums. He plays some harmonica. But really, he thought, you know, maybe we could get together and hang out from time to time. And maybe if we did that, we could also pick a good cause or two, and do a little charity work, and then go have a beer. And you know, from that comes not only the 220 some odd Parrot Head Clubs now, but also their motto, which is that we party with a purpose. And every year they give a lot of time and a lot of money to different charities. And, you know, Jimmy and the people at Margaritaville have done their part to encourage it and to help it along and to, you know, let them use logos and trademarks and stuff like that. But that was all pretty independent. You know, it came out of just fans wanting to hang out with other fans. And, so it was that spirit of community that came out of it. And, you know, once a year, twice a year, they all get together. And, you know, also Jimmy Buffett is on stage while they're partying and having their fun and catching up.
That's a nice soundtrack to have going on while you're having a party.
Yep.
In the book, you quote him as saying, "Our fans are listening to the songs, and that's the satisfaction I get out of it. As long as I can do this and as long as I know that I'm doing it, I'm going to be content to stay at a certain level. I'm not going out there to try and sell my lifestyle to America, because they ain't going to buy it. They never have." So maybe he didn't go out there to sell his lifestyle to America, but America did come calling and said, "Hey, no, we will buy this lifestyle," didn't they?
Yeah, whether you like it or not. And so you might as well make your peace with it and sell it to us in larger and larger parcels if you can. I loved that quote. That was from December 1976, right before Margaritaville came out, interview with High Times, which was, you know, maybe the best, one of the best interviews that he's ever done. It wasn't, you know, the questions were really good. The answers were really interesting. You know, he really went into some depth in that one. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, time will make a fool of us all if we're lucky enough to be given an opportunity to have it happen. Because America, you're right, America did buy his lifestyle. There's also a great quote in the book from, my friends rolled their eyes as I was working on this, and I would try to explain to them that there's a really interesting trademark law story about Margaritaville. And there is. It's fascinating that they had to go to court to get the Margaritaville trademark from the Mexican restaurant chain Chi-Chi's. But as part of that case, Irving Azoff, who was Jimmy's manager, became Jimmy's manager right after Margaritaville hit, he was deposed, and he says in the deposition that he says, I think it would be very detrimental to Jimmy Buffett's career if there were a chain of brightly colored neon Margaritaville restaurants all over the country. Or maybe not.
Until Jimmy owns and controls them, in which case right. It wouldn't be so bad.
Exactly. But, you know, nobody saw it coming. Until one day somebody did, and that was, you know, John Colin, who's the, in a lot of ways, it was John Colin, who's the CEO of Margaritaville Holdings, and he got moved from Wall Street down to Florida because the fund that he was working for, they wanted to work out of Florida, and he met Jimmy through Jimmy's wife, Jane, and Jimmy took him to New Orleans one time when they were playing the Jazz and Heritage Festival down there, and John was working with brands at the time, and brands that we know, like RC Cola, and they, like, the company he was working for, it just bought Snapple, which we all know, but we don't really ascribe much meaning to RC Cola. It's just a cola that, you know, sometimes somebody has in lieu of Pepsi or Coke.
Right.
And he was standing out on the side of the stage watching Jimmy at Jazz Fest in front of, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 people, however many can jam in front of the main stage at Jazz Fest down there. And he looked at all the costuming and he was like, well, this is a brand. And then in 1998, Jimmy called him up and, Universal Seagram's wanted to license his name for a restaurant at the Universal City Walk down in Orlando. And Jimmy wasn't sure that he wanted to just hand that over, but asked if John might be interested in helping him build something. And John did a little bit of research and took a bit of a chance on his own because he was making piles and piles and piles of money on Wall Street, and this was not a sure thing. But he seemed like maybe that there was something that you could really work with and that it would be fun to do it. And he helped grow that into everything that it's become because it turned out that there was definitely something there to work with.
Margaritaville and the whole company has exploded. So the t-shirt shop takes off, and then from there they just decide slowly, or is there ever like a real we're going to conquer the world mentality? Or is it like, yeah, the t-shirt shop works, why don't we do another one? And then suddenly somebody says, yeah, you know, what about a restaurant? How does he blow up into what he becomes?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, it's the small snowball starting, you know, being started down the mountain. In a lot of ways, you know, the restaurant was the next logical thing in Key West because people would show up at Margaritaville and they would expect some margaritas. They would expect a cheeseburger, and they didn't have those. And so the opportunity to get some space on Duval Street in Key West came up, and Jimmy turned to a guy who he'd known off and on because he used to run some clubs up in Manhattan, and had a background in running these businesses, and talked him into helping build the first margarita. And Kevin and, oh man, I'm blanking on his last name. Kevin, who Jimmy turned to, he had a very specific hamburger recipe that he won't divulge. But that was the original Cheeseburger in Paradise, and he had that recipe put together every day for the restaurant. And he made the very smart decision that they didn't want to be too expensive, but they didn't want everything to be too cheap either. He didn't want a situation like you get down at Sloppy Joe's down the street on Friday nights where there's drunk after drunk being tossed out onto the curb and fights and stuff like that, which, you know, it happens less now, but it was, I think, far more frequent back in the mid-80s. So he created this kind of mid-range restaurant that you could bring anybody to. And I think that was the beginning of this concept wherein the Margaritaville in Las Vegas and the Margaritaville in Orlando are, you know, both possibly, you know, depending on what happens, the highest grossing restaurants in those cities every year. And so you've got Vegas, kind of America's sin capital, and Orlando, America's family destination, and Margaritaville fits perfectly in both of those for what people are looking for. And that started all with Kevin Boucher. And kind of helping set that model and helping Jimmy get Jimmy and Sunshine get the restaurant going. And so Key West led to New Orleans. New Orleans to Orlando, you know, t-shirts became a few more products because people were asking for them. You know, there's, you know, people asked, you know, parrot heads who would run into Jimmy would say, "Hey, I have to wear a tie to work every day. Do you have any, why don't you have any parrot ties?" Well, okay, we'll do ties. What the heck? Hawaiian shirts, that seems like a natural thing. And it just, you know, opportunities start to present themselves. As you become popular, people want to be associated with you, and they want their products associated with you, and they want to sign licensing deals with you. And, you know, pretty soon somebody's saying, "Hey, can we partner on, can we build you an $800 million resort in your Disney World? Can we do the $1 billion retirement community?" Because there's opportunity there, and people are interested in it. So, you know, there's a point where it just kind of takes on a life of its own, and that's certainly what's happened here, really, in the last 5 or 6 years. It's exploded in ways that nobody could have imagined.
Are Jimmy and Jane still together?
They are. I believe this year is their 40th wedding anniversary. They got married after Margaritaville hit. The Eagles played the wedding in Aspen. there are some fantastic stories from that wedding.
That's insane, isn't it, though, that they made it 40? I mean, because he's on the road so much. I can't imagine she travels with him like crazy, right?
You know, that's one of those things where, I mean, you don't see her a lot. She stays kind of below the radar. And honestly, I was so interested in the work and the culture of this that, you know, they've clearly worked hard to keep parts of their lives private, and I felt like, you know, I felt like that was a thing to be respected. And so, you know, I think she's there sometimes. I think other times she isn't. She's, you know, obviously got her own interests and her own things, and they certainly have the resources to be wherever they want, whenever
they
want.
Yes, they do. Now, and I don't know how much you went into, but there was a Cheeseburger in Paradise right near us not that long ago here in the suburbs of Chicago that closed down. And restaurant businesses are notoriously fickle. So the empire, I imagine, goes up, goes down. But I would also guess that while Jimmy has been very much in control of his career and things like that, and was kind of famous for, you know, you said liner notes and things like that, like really taking control of a lot of stuff, he has this persona of laid back, half drunk all the time, just singing songs, but that wasn't the true Jimmy Buffett. That was a little more of a easy to slip into persona on the stage. Do you know how involved he is with the business, or other people run that? It's been pretty well, and I'll just worry about being on stage and doing that stuff.
He stays involved. You know, it's not a day-to-day thing, but it's a week-to-week thing. John updates him. They share office space in West Palm Beach. They've got a, you know, the main corporate headquarters are in Orlando, but John and Jimmy have some offices there in West Palm, near where they both live. And he certainly stays involved, and he keeps up to date on it, but I think it's much less than he used to be. I think, you know, I think that there was a time he was more involved in it. And, you know, we all learn to let go of some things. And, you know, to go back to Springsteen, who I've also written about, you know, he's loosened up greatly in the last few years about, you know, what he puts out and what he doesn't. For years, it was everything had to be very tightly packaged and very tightly. He had to have his narrative arc. He had to know that it was up to his, you know, his standards. And now they just release every show that they do online, which, you know, in part is just a practical thing because people were bootlegging them anyways. And in the internet, they were getting out and getting everywhere. So you might as well charge $9.99 for them and give people a much better recording of it. But, you know, I think as Jimmy has gotten older, he's less involved, but he also can be less involved because he picked the right people to take care of his businesses and his image. And one of the things that you encounter when you start exploring Margaritaville is people hang out there for a long, long time. The people that work with him have worked with him for a long, long time. One of the first employees of the Margaritaville store is still his archivist, and she lives down in Key West. She's been on the payroll since 1985. Sunshine Smith, like I was saying, you know, points on the flamingo. Michael Utley, still out there every night. Mac McAnally has been playing with him for 25 years. He's largely had the same, you know, fantastic band since the early 90s. And one of the reasons that they're all still around is because they're professionals and they know how to do their job, and Jimmy doesn't have to worry about them. And that allows him more time to do the things that he enjoys to do, which is, you know, I think we could all agree, a pretty healthy work-life balance if you can pull that off.
Well, now it's, I'm sure he has more ability. It sounds like, you know, the stories from early in the book, there was no work-life balance. I mean, I guess work was life for him at the time, and it was a party, so it evened out. But it was all work, and it certainly paid off in the end. And Margaritaville, the musical, that's how it's called, Escape to Margaritaville, is actually going to have a pre-Broadway debut here in Chicago this fall.
Yeah, so. that might be my excuse to get back to Chicago. I'm really curious to see what they've done with that, because he's had over the years so many stabs at really actualizing Margaritaville in that way. There was, throughout the 80s, there was this constant talk of a Margaritaville movie, and I actually have a script that was written and finished and sent around to Harrison Ford and Robert Redford, amongst others. But, you know, it called for a smuggler and a cowboy. So, I mean, if you were looking for a smuggler and a cowboy in 1987, you were going to send it to Harrison Ford and Robert Redford. And so he's been trying to do this for some time, and I'd be really, really curious to see how they did it and what it looks like and what it sounds like. You know, and he was smart enough to stick to kind of the core songs. He knows what people want, and he's happy to provide it. And so it'll be interesting, because it's opening in San Diego now, and then Chicago, Houston, New Orleans, and they got their sights set on Broadway in 18.
And do you know? And I know it just premiered in California, but is it all songs, or is there some actual dialogue mixed in?
Oh, they built the whole story. I know that much. I think it involves somebody who works too much and somebody who doesn't. The themes are constant. The themes you never stray too far away from, because, you know, the themes have proven pretty timeless.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Yeah. Jimmy Buffett is enduring and so much fun and still having a good time out on the road. You can catch him in Chicago in July at Wrigley Field. Catch the musical this fall and get the book at your local bookstore online now. Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way. Lots of great stories about Buffett from the early days and beyond by Ryan White. Find more on Ryan at ryanwwhite.com. Thank you so much for spending the time today, Ryan.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Some of it's magic, some of it's tragic, but I had a good life all the way. He went to Paris looking for answers to questions that bothered him so.